called feeble-minded and locked up in institutions. And if you were in one of those institutions, whether you were indigent or an unwed mother or had some sort of mental incapacity, there's a good chance that you may have been incorporated in some sort of medical study, possibly for the government or not, where you would have been used and abused.
Assisted by the German scientists, the Americans begin pursuing their goal of the ultimate weapon, and everything is allowed in the name of the Cold War. On the one side was the Army, whose priority is to win the nuclear arms race. At the time, to test the effects of radiation on a large scale, they used their own soldiers, who were docile and disciplined. Between 1946 and 1962, between 250,000 and 500,000 men were exposed to radiation on Bikini Atoll or in the Nevada desert. They were exposed with no protection, unaware of the risks involved. And afterwards, the radiated particles were cleaned up with brooms.
How about radiation? You think there's much danger from radiation?
Well, radiation is the least of the worries that the men are thinking about.
I think most people thought that radiation was the greatest danger, didn't they? Where did they learn different?
Well, prior to our instructions here, we received a very thorough briefing before we even came in this close to contact with it.
On the other side was the CIA, who was above all interested in psychological manipulation. Their goal was to create an infallible truth serum, wipe memories, turn humans into robots, and program them to kill. Conveniently, in 1948, a researcher in the Sandoz laboratories, Albert Hoffman, discovers a molecule that ignites the Secret Service, lysergic acid diethylamide, or LSD. It's derived from the same rye fungus, long held responsible for the incident at Pont Saint-Esprit. It was believed that the hallucinogenic properties of this drug were key to psychological manipulation. Fearing that the Russians would get their hands on Sandoz's samples, the Americans bought all of their stock. The discovery of LSD was a godsend for the Army, who on the brink of nuclear weapons were looking for a weapon that could defeat an enemy without firing any weapons. The man who was head of this program longest was James Ketchum, shown here in uniform. He was a psychiatrist who was working for the military. As a patriot, he was prepared to push the boundaries in his research. He tested around 30 drugs, but especially LSD and the dangerous benzylate. He treated 7,000 soldiers, hundreds of whom later sued the Army because of the side effects that they still experience and attribute to these drugs. However, when questioned, James Ketchum sees things differently.
I think they were very patriotic. They've not been given credit. They've been called innocent guinea pigs, which they certainly were not. They knew what they were doing, and we told them as much as we could about it. We had to limit the names of the drugs because some of them were artificially made, and if we were to give out the name, of course, that would also reveal the structure, and that we were afraid the Russians would get that. They were apparently following our work. We thought they were ahead of us, but actually they weren't, and so they were watching what we did to see what they could learn and use, and they developed a similar drug later themselves.
In parallel with the Army, the CIA was also developing its own programs, codenamed Bluebird, Artichoke, and later MKUltra. But to carry out these programs on a large scale, they needed funds. In 1950, the Korean War gave them the ideal pretext. Some American soldiers were captured. During their detention, pilots admitted having dropped chemical weapons onto Korea, which was forbidden. The Americans claimed this was due to psychological manipulation, and the CIA took advantage of this godsend to obtain budgets that allowed them to work on brainwashing.
During the Korean War, the American pilots who were captured started making apparently false confessions of germ warfare. The first question is, was it really false confessions? But then when they were brought back to the United States, the military and the military psychiatrists studied them and decided that there's mind control operations being run against Americans. So for defensive purposes, we had to study this, figure it out, therefore we created MKUltra. Before MKUltra was Bluebird and Artichoke. So the whole rationale is it's defensive. It's because of what the communists are doing. Problem is, the Korean War started in June 1950, and Bluebird was signed into operation by the head of the CIA in April 1950.
In the Edgewood camp where James Ketchum worked, soldiers are called upon more and more. They think they're testing gas masks. In reality, the canisters are filled with a toxic chemical.
They were testing a whole assortment of different hallucinogens like LSD and marijuana and things like that. And they explored other drugs, very high levels of atropine, scopolamine, benzolates, very powerful. And a lot of these soldiers ended up incapacitated. It took them a long time to recover. And while they're in recovery, the doctors cannot do any more experiments because it's basically a very small base and testing operation. In other words, they needed a new site.
It's in this context of the Cold War and secret agents that on the 16th of August, 1951, the tragedy at Pont-Saint-Esprit unfolded. France was suffering economically, and the Americans distrusted this ally they couldn't control. The village was under the control of socialists at the time. In the eyes of America, they were Reds, the epitome of the Soviet danger. But the mayor, Roger Castillon, doesn't believe in a foreign conspiracy. Yet American experts like Colin Ross are much more down to earth.
Obviously, that compound didn't just come in the rain, or just wasn't sitting around naturally. It was obviously organized, controlled, distributed. So whether it was actually LSD or some other compound, well, doesn't make that much difference. Pont-Saint-Esprit is actually not just this happened once in the world in a village in France. It's consistent with all the other experiments on the public that have done in the United States and done for a documented fact.
To achieve their goals, would the Americans be prepared to use a whole village as a laboratory? After all, these are civilians, not trained soldiers. However, in September 1950, nearly 1 year before Pont-Saint-Esprit, this is exactly what they did, and in their own country. Off the coast of San Francisco, the American Marines were carrying out military maneuvers. A ship approached the coast and bombarded the city with a bacteria causing nucosomia, Serratia marcescens. The military were testing the effects of spraying this through the air. This classified secret defense map shows the scale of the targeted area. At least 11 people were hospitalized, one of whom died of pneumonia. The villagers wonder why a supposedly festive drug that is loved by hippies would have had such terrifying effects at Pont-Saint-Esprit. James Ketchum, the military psychiatrist who specialized in LSD, a little reluctantly, admits that the drug is scary for those who take it unknowingly.
Some individuals could have a bad trip if someone gave them LSD and didn't tell them about it. That's very anxiety-producing. Or if they were inexperienced and not particularly well balanced themselves, took a fairly large dose of LSD, they could have a bad trip. How would you feel if you had a cup of coffee and started to see things going like this or like this, brilliant colors appear on the ceiling, or Suddenly you felt you're out of your body and looking down on yourself. These are all things that can happen with LSD.
But can these effects have a delayed onset? In Pont-Saint-Esprit, the older generation remember the night of the apocalypse, where dozens of men went mad and were sectioned in a psychiatric unit because of terrifying visions. This night took place more than 2 weeks after the cursed bread was consumed. But again, James Ketchum admits that it's possible.
Some individuals had flashbacks later in which they would go into a situation where they had been when they were taking LSD and have a flood of the same emotions and some of them anxiety producing.
In 1951, French investigators also consider LSD and call upon Albert Hoffman, inventor of the drug. On the spot, he tells the investigators that he has no doubt that the hallucinations were due to LSD. But after returning to Switzerland, he backtracks, claiming he was mistaken. The French want explanations, but public health documents from 1951 show that the expert became suddenly unreachable. We are sorry that the eminent professor has not been able to get back in touch with us.
I would think if the Sandoz scientists are saying it doesn't seem to be LSD, they're just trying to cover up the fact that it's 100% for sure that LSD must have come from Sandoz, because they were the only suppliers. That's nothing more than a cover-up.
After months of inquiry, the French investigators were so disoriented by the number of fruitless leads that the incident at Pont-Saint-Esprit falls victim to its own mystery. During this time, the experiments continued in the United States, and they reached a level never seen before in any country, including the Soviet bloc.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. Or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is
this
for
is,
a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
Sheikh Javed Akbari, the researcher on Islamic studies from Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are welcome to your program For a Better Life with me, Javed Akbari. In this episode, we are going to talk about akhlaq in life or ethics in life. Of course, the word akhlaq has been translated differently by different scholars. Generally speaking, the word akhlaq is the practice of virtue, morality, and manners, Islamic theology. The word akhlaq is most commonly translated as disposition, nature, temper, and it has also been translated as ethics, morals, or manners, and so on and so forth. And obviously, a person with a good akhlaq or with a good morality is a person who has good manners. A person who has good manners is a person who has good akhlaq. That is the vice versa. So he behaves well and he is known as a good character in society. Some of you might be interested in understanding the word akhlaq, in understanding the root, of course, whether the word akhlaq is the plural form or the singular form. I should tell you that the word akhlaq is the plural of the word khulq, which means disposition. Now, disposition actually is a faculty of the soul. Generally, we use the word malaka to describe a trait of the soul. So disposition is actually a faculty of the soul which unconsciously inspires activities. As I said, we usually use the word malaka in Arabic or in Farsi. So the word malaka comes into, not the word malaka, but the malaka itself actually comes into existence through repetitive practice. And of course, it's not destroyed easily. Once the malaka is established, once this faculty of the soul is established, then it does not fade away. A particular faculty of the soul or a particular malaka may appear because of a habit formed by continual repetition of certain acts, which obviously leads to a certain disposition. So what is very important is the repetition of certain acts, which ultimately or finally leads to a certain disposition. Malaka actually is formed through practice and conscious effort. If the practice and conscious effort are persistent, they will eventually produce a disposition. Let's have a short break, dear brothers and sisters.
Every breath, I solemnly promise to try to live my life for you. Oh Allah, you did revive my soul and shone your light into my heart. So please, you is now my only goal. Oh, I love you so, I love you so.
If you want to, for example, be a pious person, you should have the faculty, you should have the disposition. And that disposition is not created overnight. It comes into existence by and by and with the passage of time, provided that obviously the person has the determination and the resolve to change himself and to make himself better. You know, man is a free agent. He exercises free will. He has the volition to change himself because he is not actually living a life led by instincts. No, he is a free agent and he exercises free will. He exercises free will. So man changes his life, his habit and manners by making conscious efforts. When he is making efforts to change himself, he is doing it consciously. He knows in the back of his mind that he is trying to change himself. Sometimes, of course, a man's habit is formed by the environment in which he lives. Because if you put yourself in an environment which is either good or bad, so depending on the environment, sometimes the environment is good, sometimes it's bad. So it is the environment that shapes, of course, your character or the character of a child. Especially a child is more vulnerable and more susceptible to the environment or the setting in which a child lives, whether the environment is created by the family or it is the society that creates the environment. At the end of the day, it is the environment that shapes his character and his personality. Obviously, a person cannot escape the influence of the environment. Whether the environment is good or bad, it will have an impact on your conduct and on your behavior. Now, children and youngsters are more vulnerable. They are susceptible to the influence or to the impact of the environment. And environment has its impact on you willy-nilly, whether you want it or not. So it has its impact. Sometimes you make your own independent and conscious effort to change your life, to better it, to improve it, to live a better life, because you have the capacity to change it. You have the ability to change it. You have been gifted with the power, with the will, with the resolve to change your life, to make it better, to change your personality, and to live a life characterized by ethics, by morality, by goodness, and by moral values, of course. Welcome back. This is For a Better Life from IRIB English Radio. We discussed the hypocrites. When we speak of man's capacity to change his dispositions, we do not mean he should destroy his instincts. We do not mean he should suppress his instincts or his desires. Of course, the desires are there, the instincts are there, and sometimes those instincts can actually overpower the individual. But living a life or changing one's position and the capacity to change one's dispositions, of course, does not mean that we should destroy our instincts. We should, of course, take care of those desires. We should take care of those instincts and make sure at the same time that they do not mislead us, that they do not lead us away from the right path. Because instincts can do this. The instincts, if they spiral out of control, they can actually lead a person out of the right path. It is very much important that one should try to maintain moderation and not to go to extremes, and of course to control his instincts, and of course make at the same time deliberate and conscious efforts to change his life, to create a change, a positive change in his life. The Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family has been reported to have said, "The most complete of believers in Iman, in terms of Iman, are those who are best in character." It has also been reported from Imam Hassan alayhi salatu wasalam, and this is the last hadith with which I would like to conclude this episode. Inna ahsan al hasan al khulq al hasan. The best of good things is good manners. With this, we come to the end of this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share.
You heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Iran calls for a reasonable and documented response to its proposals as JCPOA members end talks on the removal of U.S. sanctions in Vienna. The French president comes under fire for his visit to Saudi Arabia, with a former top UN official saying that Macron seeks to rehabilitate the Saudi crown prince. And the U.S. military says initial assessment of its latest drone strike in northwest Syria points to civilian casualties. Welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran's chief negotiator to the Vienna talks says the two proposed drafts Tehran has presented to other parties cannot be rejected. Ali Bagharikani told Al Jazeera TV that the draft documents are based on the provisions of the 2015 Iran nuclear agreement. He added that Iran will submit a third proposal once the first two are accepted. He insisted that U.S. sanctions against Iran must be lifted immediately. Iran proposed its documents during the latest round of talks that ended on Friday in Vienna. Tehran has already made it clear that the negotiations should be result-oriented. It says that the talks should lead to the removal of the sanctions that the U.S. imposed after it withdrew from the nuclear deal in 2018.
Following a meeting with the signatories of the nuclear agreement, known as the JCPOA, Iran calls for a reasonable, documented, and rational response to its proposals for the removal of U.S. sanctions and Iran's return to full compliance. Deputy Foreign Minister and lead negotiator Ali Bagharikani said Britain, France and Germany were not happy with some of Iran's proposals.
They had no complaint about these proposals being irrelevant, but they say they are not consistent with our viewpoints, and I told them this is natural. We are not supposed to express ideas that are in line with your viewpoints. We take our own interests and policies into consideration. The important point is that they are based on principles that all sides agree on. No European side claims that Iran's proposals lack legal basis.
A diplomatic source close to the Iranian negotiating team said the country's proposed drafts were in complete conformity with the JCPOA, adding it was regrettable that some European sides were attempting to dictate their own demands round the negotiating table while failing to acknowledge that a revival of the deal requires compliance by all sides.
I think the current administration, what it is saying is that the JCPOA, the nuclear deal, good or bad, is something that Iran's accepted and we will commit ourselves to it. However, we will not allow the other side to retain sanctions, maximum pressure sanctions, and then expect us to go back to 2015. That simply won't happen.
EU coordinator Enrico Mora said there were substantial challenges ahead, while time to reach an agreement was not unlimited. While Iran is calling for a rational and documented response to its proposals, European diplomats are expressing concern and scepticism. The Vienna talks are set to resume next week when it may become more clear whether the gaps can be bridged. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
John Stepling is an author and commentator who joins us. John Stepling, at this point we're looking at talks to resume this week. Maybe there are also some doubts maybe on that. However, at this point, what is your assessment on what has occurred in the past week?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. If you go back, if you Google Iran JCPOA, you know, Vienna talks, any of these things, U.S.-Iran relations, Google that. You know, this is a repeat of 2007, 2011, 2012, 2014, 2017. We have literally heard the same headlines six, seven, eight times. There's always a variation. Israel is arguing with John Kerry, or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. It's this political rhetoric that goes on and on. EU nations voice skepticism. We have heard this countless times. The U.S. has no intention of returning to the JCPOA. They are trying to isolate Iran, like most foreign policy strategies from the U.S. over the last several years. It's going to fail. The U.S. is the nation that finds itself isolated, and you know, it resorts to wholesale bullying of EU countries to get them to fall in line. These diplomats voice skepticism. They don't even really understand the nature of the entire thing. They were just told to say that. The truth of this entire narrative is that there should never have been a JCPOA. There should never have been the need for one. There should never have been sanctions certainly put on Iran. We have countries like Israel unsigned to any nuclear deal that we know has a huge arsenal of nuclear weapons. There are countless other countries, Pakistan, China, that have nuclear weapons. But somehow this narrative is that Iran is a pariah state in some fashion. The reasons for this are never given, because Iran has really not done anything except bend over backwards to try to accommodate the U.S. in these talks, fruitlessly, and it will continue to be fruitless. The entire thing just feels like, and Anthony Blinken's most recent comments are just stunningly patronizing, condescending, paternalistic, and that's what one has come to expect from the U.S. It's insulting. Iran has been, I think, extraordinarily patient and accommodating in a situation that is an insult nationally to them. The U.S. is a crumbling empire domestically. It has massive problems, unemployment, in crumbling infrastructure. They have a foreign policy predicated on aggression, what they call humanitarian intervention, 900 military bases around the world. They don't have enough soldiers. They don't manage the upkeep of their weapons and defense systems are in disarray. All the research on new weapons, certainly naval vessels and so forth, has been a failure, embarrassing failure. They are a crumbling empire. And you know, in such situations, they become more defensive, more aggressive, and more unpredictable. Mm-hmm. But I think in this, that they're never going to come back to the JCPOA. They don't see any benefit in it. It won't sell domestically. And they're not going to do it. They want to be seen as hardline, tough guy, Western, the global cop, and that's the Iran should just give up, I think, trying to accommodate them.
Okay, thank you very much for that. John Stepling, author and commentator from Inderoy. Yemen says its armed forces have shot down a U.S.-made spy drone over Mari province. Army spokesman Yahya Sari says the aircraft was of the Scan Eagle type. Says that it was the seventh American-made drone downed by Yemeni forces this year. Marib is a key Yemeni province that's witnessing clashes between the army and the Saudi-backed former regime loyalists for months now. The army and its allied Ansarullah forces are trying to liberate the province from the Saudi-backed elements. In the past several weeks, the army has made significant gains. The U.S. military launches an investigation after acknowledging possible civilian casualties in its latest drone strike in northwest Syria. The spokesman for the U.S. Central Command says an initial assessment of the attack on a suspected al-Qaeda leader points to the civilian casualties. He did not mention the name of the target or the exact location of Friday's strike. Earlier this week, the Pentagon chief ordered a review of a 2019 bombing of an alleged Daesh hideout in Syria's Deir al-Zor province. That came after a New York Times report disclosed that 70 civilians, mainly women and children, were killed in that airstrike. The U.S. has long been accused of concealing civilian deaths caused by its aerial attacks in the countries where it has troops under the pretext of fighting terrorism. Those countries include Iraq and Syria. Author and researcher Greg Simmons says it is no more a mistake if the U.S. keeps attacking civilians in Syria or elsewhere and then claims it was a mistake.
It becomes something more than a mistake if you keep on repeating the same failures year after year, strike after strike. I can remember when there was an attempt about 10, 15 years ago for those associated with the Pentagon to go around these different academic conferences and say drone strikes were the ethical and moral alternative to other types of military operations. So this is an attempt to kind of humanize this kind of inhuman warfare. There's no transparency and no accountability. And no matter how many they kill, they first of all try to deny, cover up, make a partial admission, and then bury it and repeat the same track once more.
U.S. President Joe Biden vows to prevent a possible Russian invasion of Ukraine amid mounting tensions between Moscow and the West. Biden says that he's preparing a series of initiatives to make it, quote, very, very difficult for Russia to invade its neighbor. Biden warns that he won't accept any red lines set by his Russian counterpart, President Vladimir Putin, over Ukraine. The two leaders are due to hold a video teleconference within days to discuss the crisis. It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. The French President Emmanuel Macron is in Saudi Arabia for talks with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. His trip is overshadowed by the 2018 assassination of Saudi critic and journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Macron is the first major Western leader to visit the kingdom since Khashoggi was killed in October 2018. American intelligence agencies have concluded that the murder was ordered by Mohammed bin Salman, known as MBS. Now human rights groups are accusing the French president of trying to, quote, rehabilitate MBS. Critics say nothing can justify Macron's trip, given Saudi Arabia's rights record.
Whatever strategic interest France has in Saudi Arabia, nothing can justify their legitimization of a ruler who kills journalists, threatens activists, imprisons women human rights defenders, slaughters Yemeni civilians, and deceives the international community. Macron diminishes himself and his country as he stoops to partnership with MBS.
Macron is rejecting the accusations, arguing that Saudi Arabia is a major actor in the Middle East where crises cannot be dealt with by ignoring it. A business delegation of about 100 French companies is due to attend an investment forum during Macron's trip. The visit is part of a two-day tour to the Persian Gulf that earlier took Macron to the UAE and Qatar. In the UAE, he signed a deal worth $19 billion to sell French-made Rafale fighter jets to the Arab country. The UAE is part of a Saudi-led coalition fighting the war in Yemen. Arnaud Develay is an international lawyer who joins us from Damascus. We also have Saeed Chahabi, who's a political analyst and Middle East expert, who joins us from London. I'd like to welcome you both. Saeed Chahabi, let me first start with you. You're looking at the French president, of which the headlines are reading that he is interested in rehabilitating the Saudi crown prince. What do you make of this trip, which is really the first official visit of a high-ranking official to Saudi Arabia?
Thank you very much. To me, this is one of the most hypocritical political stand by France and indeed by the West. Because 3 years now, or 3.5 years after the killing of Khashoggi and...
Okay, unfortunately we lost Saeed Chahabi. Arnaud Develay, so you're looking at a trip here by the French president to the Persian Gulf region. It's filled with what seems to be the case when it comes to the relationship between the Persian Gulf monarchies and Western countries like France, UK, and the United States, and that's the sale of arms. Do you think that the French president's trip incentive is due to the sales of arms, which we have seen to the UAE is to the tune of billions when it comes to Rafale jets?
Yes, thank you for having me. Absolutely. France is competing arduously with the UK and the United States in selling all kind of weapon systems, not only to Saudi Arabia, of course, but also the UAE, as you mentioned in your opening report, with $19 billion worth of sales in Rafales. To the extent, you know, the human rights organizations have been decrying Macron's visit as the first Western leader to pay a visit to Mohammed bin Salman since the Khashoggi affair. Let's recall that in the wake of this assassination, France did not even interrupt the sale of weapons to Saudi Arabia. France considers Saudi Arabia as a major bilateral partner in terms of investment and in terms of commercial interaction. And this has not surprised anyone, really, since on the whole, with Gulf monarchies, France has always had very ambiguous and, I would say, problematic ties. Let's recall the Qatar enmeshing into French politics, which was very well documented in a book written by Georges Marbonneau and Christian Cheneau, called My Dear, The Dear Emirs, which chronicled how Qatar essentially paid the entire French political class cash money and gold watches and all kind of junkets, where French politician figures would be spotted going to the Qatari embassy in Paris at all kind of times of day and night. And so this has been very well documented. The whole French political class is corrupt, going back to the mid-2000s with the Sarkozy administration, going on with François Hollande, and Qatar even actually sued one of the cadre of the then National Front, Florian Philippot, after this politician underlined and decried and denounced those practices, and Philippot won. So basically, the French political class has no compulsion in preaching human rights principles and universal values as the embodiment of France, a legacy to the world. But actions speak louder than words. And we have to remind our viewers that France is entering a pre-election period, and it was an opportunity for Emmanuel Macron to rally support from potential sponsors for the reason that elections cost money. And you can be sure that more than ever before, Macron presents himself now as the ultimate fiduciary agent of many oligarchical interests. And in that respect, everything is perfectly coherent with what we've seen the last 15 years.
We're going to end it there. Thank you very much. Let me thank Arnaud Develay, international lawyer from Damascus, and Syed Chaabi. We do apologize. He spoke a little bit, though, political analyst and Middle East expert from London. With that, we come to an end for this news review. Thanks for tuning in.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The role of outstanding people in helping the country reach the front lines of global science. This is a part of the speech delivered on November 17, 2021 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with a number of the academic elite and top scientific talents of the country. Another point about the academic elite is that scientific personalities, as our discussion is about scientific personalities, must look to the future, the horizon drawn for science in the country, and pay attention to this. I have said before that we should move in such a way that in a reasonable period of time, a few years ago, I spoke of 50 years, Iran will be a source of science in the world. In other words, if people want to know about the latest scientific findings, they will have to learn Farsi. This is possible to happen in the future. You should not be surprised at this. It was like this one day in the world. Once, at a point in history, our scientists were at the pinnacle of knowledge in the world. Their books received careful attention and were cited in all the universities of the world. In the universities of the West and the East, India, China and the like, which were also centers of knowledge at that time. We must look to this horizon.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
A depiction of the stages for reaching the pinnacle of science in the world. Of course, there are certain stages needed for this. The first stage is to bridge the gap between us and other countries in terms of science. We have a large gap to fill. Of course, we admire the scientific progress we have made, as our statistics, which are based on global statistics, prove. This scientific progress is commendable, and we have truly made progress. However, we are far from being on the front lines of science in the world, and this is due to the fact that they have kept us behind for 200 years. After the victory of the revolution, a movement took place, and starting about two decades ago, a faster movement began. We have made good progress, but we are still a long way off. The first step is to fill this gap. The second step is to progress past the borders of world knowledge. In other words, we should be able to offer new scientific aids and new scientific discoveries to the world. I will expand on this later, and the next step after this is to pursue a new Islamic civilization.
And a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The family of Agnes Wanjiru, a young Kenyan mother murdered by British troops almost a decade ago, is now filing charges to demand answers over her death. The brother-in-law of the murdered Kenyan woman speaks here about his pain and suffering.
Nine British soldiers joked about her death on social media several years later. The family now hope this fresh investigation will give them the answers they so desperately need.
I feel a lot of pain when I remember Agnes. We brought her up well, and just as she was settling down, her life was taken away, leaving us to fend for her young child. It's my hope that this child will get justice.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today we are focusing on the reopening of the file of a young Kenyan woman brutally murdered by British troops training in central Kenya in 2012. Kenyan members of parliament now say they're having attempts to cover up the murder. In the second part of our program, we shall look at the exaggerated reports of the return of some African artifacts looted by Western countries, especially France. The question many are asking is this: are Western countries willing to return every single artifact they stole from Africa?
Kenyan woman murdered by British troops. The body of 21-year-old Kenyan woman Agnes Wanjiru was found in 2012 after she went out partying with British troops at a hotel in the central Kenyan town of Nanyuku, where the British Army has a permanent garrison. Last October, one of the troops involved confessed to killing Wanjiru, and now the family of the murdered woman is demanding for justice. The governor of Kenya's Laikipia County, where the murder took place, says the crime brings back memories of atrocities committed by Britain during the colonial rule.
The revelations have reignited calls for an independent investigation and justice for Wanjiru. Kenyan authorities have announced that they are reopening the case. The sister of the murdered Kenyan is emotional over the revival of the murder file.
Recently, when the media started airing the story, it opened old wounds. It's like Agnes has just died. It has even affected her daughter, but we had to let her know what is going on. I pray that God grants the British government the wisdom to handle this case well. When I think of Agnes, I remember how happy she was. She loved to sing. She taught my youngest daughter how to sing. The person who killed Agnes should face the law, because the child who was orphaned has suffered a lot. Bearing in mind she was just 5 months old, even feeding at that time was difficult.
Well, for more on this murder file involving British troops in Kenya, my colleague contacted Patrick Gathara, a writer and political cartoonist. He's also the curator of the Kenya news website, The Elephant. Now, Mr. Gathara first explains here on why it has taken almost 10 years for this case to come back to limelight.
The case of Agnes Wanjiru has taken so long simply because she was killed initially allegedly by the British soldiers, she was missing for about 2 months before her body was actually recovered from a septic tank. And by the time her body was found, the soldiers had already left the country. And then that was the initial delay. Then there was also sort of quite a bit of delay in setting up an inquiry that then decided that the British soldiers were most likely responsible for her death. And in addition to that, there was quite a lot of laxity in terms of both governments in following up the case.
Well, the Defense and Foreign Relations Committee in Kenya's parliament has raised concerns that the authorities could be engaged in cover-up, hence delay in Agnes Wanjiru's murder case.
It's a scandal of a cover-up. It's purely because the junior officers reported to their seniors, and their seniors never took necessary action.
We asked Mr. Gathara to give us his take on why Britain's Ministry of Defense deliberately refused to investigate the brutal murder of Wanjiru in 2012 amid reports of a plot to cover up this heinous crime.
There was a deliberate attempt to cover it up, or at least to there was some hope that it would go away. I think we have seen in Kenya quite a number of cases involving British and even American soldiers and sailors, where they have come and committed crimes here, killed people, killed animals, started fires, you know, and stuff, and then kind of disappeared. So when they go away and we don't really see justice done, we don't see them being pursued, either by our own authorities here in Kenya or by the British or American authorities. So this is not a new thing, it's not the first time, and we need to keep in mind that there has been, since colonial days, a pattern where atrocities committed against locals are treated as if they are not very serious, and there is a tendency to sweep them under the rug.
Allegations against British troops serving in Kenya and elsewhere around the world have dogged the British government and military.
The UK has nothing to hide here.